C1R, number 7A.
We continue with the tone of the Christ as the Christ. We are now in the level of Christian Science. And we have seen that on the level of absolute Christian Science, the whole tone of the Christ ended with the question, what is intelligence? Then showing that intelligence is the primal quality of mind, and that that mind is omniscient, that that mind knows all, has a terrific idea, is a true idea. And now from the point of view of the relative standpoint of Christian Science, we have now here the Christ that says, well, that mind which is the omniscient mind that knows all is good, and man should have that mind which is only good. So this is not the definition of mind as the nature of mind. This is defining the Christ as being that mind which is good. So the quality of God having a Christ which is good really comes out. And we have seen that that corroborates with that second statement in the four fundamental proposition of divine metaphysics in the sixth chapter, so that we have here that that mind, good, is the only mind that exists. Now, Mrs. Eddy gives here quite a long thesis on that mind, because I think she feels she has to show here something very big, namely that we should rely on that mind which is always working out the purpose of good. This is quite an interesting point insofar as we know that in metaphysics we really practice the wrong way around, that in metaphysics, the Christian Scientist, actually he's not a Christian Scientist then, he's then a metaphysician, he always first conceives of that what he wants to demonstrate. It's usually so that the student says, I have a problem and I have to work out the problem. So you can see he believes that his human mind can conceive of a problem. The human mind cannot conceive of a true problem. We know that in science, the only right idea that is being brought out is that idea that starts with the divine mind and not with the human mind. Therefore, it is the divine mind alone that conceives the idea. That was what we have seen in the question, what is intelligence as the prime quality of mind, omniscient, and therefore our whole consciousness must mutate to that point where we say, I don't know what problems I have to work out. It's only the divine mind that knows the problems that have to be worked out. And here you come to a terrific differentiation between a metaphysical treatment of a case and a scientific treatment of a case. Or you can say between a metaphysical approach to our life problem or the scientific approach to our life problem. It is a completely different attitude. And I'm not surprised, really, that this attitude came in so late into recapitulation as 1891, because one can see in Mrs. Eddy's teaching that she gave in the late 1880s, when she gave those many classes in Boston, where she said that in that time she was teaching 4,000 students in the Metaphysical College, that in those classes, as far as we have notes from students of those classes, one can see that the great transformation or mutation took place, that she began to see for the first time that she could teach the students from science and no more from metaphysics. Those notes that are in the Carpenter collection and so on all show that Mrs. Eddy even said in those classes that for the first time she could teach the students the seven synonymous term, and to show that in those seven synonymous term would lie the science of healing and the healing practice. Up to that point she had to teach through arguments, through affirmation and denial. She had to teach along the line of metaphysics, and only then, at that time, that culmination point or transformation point, she began to see that the student may now be ready to go out from mind and let the omniscience of mind define and determine and outline what has to be demonstrated in people's life. So this is a terrific turning point there, which we have to imbibe closely here by seeing, all right, there is a Christ, the Christ as a Christ, which is the mind of God, and that mind of God has a good idea, has one idea which is good. Or in other terms, we can say that Christ is that which knows everything, is the omniscience of everything, and therefore knows what we need, therefore knows what we should demonstrate, what should come out and be manifested within us. So that at that point, we are asked to have that mind which is God, and no more to go out from the human mind and let the human mind determine what we should demonstrate, what should be demonstrated in our lives, and so on. That's too small, much too small, just to start out and have the human mind filling his consciousness with all sorts of things that he should work out, that he should work out a better job, a better income, a better this and a better that, and so on. This is just too small. That's what Jesus would call straining gnats and swallowing camels. The big questions are swallowed and not sown out so that can mature and that they can unfold. The camels are those big categories of being. They should be sown, and the gnats should be swallowed, the little tiny little problems that come along, which we make so big that they are right out of proportion, that they really don't matter and amount to anything in the salvation of the world. So this is here shown very nicely, that the great attitude is not to go out from the human mind, what the human mind considers to be good and divine and necessary for our life and beautiful and fulfilling our life. This is just too small. When we go out from the divine mind, then we go out from the big. And the divine mind alone knows what it wants to work out with us, what it wants to use us, for what purpose it wants to use us. And so we are, when we are going out from the synonymous term, therefore from a scientific standpoint, we can be quite sure that that mind has an idea and knows that idea and will use us at that idea and will bring out in us the maximum of good. Mind is good. That's the Christ. See, why is it the Christ? Why isn't it just the Word? It is the Christ because it says, I express myself as that which can be measured up as good. God himself, so to say, is not good. It is God expressing himself that manifests itself for our knowledge as being good. Therefore, good is not the synonymous term for God. It is just the Christ concept. God good, see, is the Christ concept that is always expressing itself as what we then measure up of being good. Now, we have seen that Mrs. Eddy builds up that whole subject because it's quite an important subject. It was that which she saw was missing all along in the recapitulation up to the 1890s, and therefore felt perhaps that this should be explained at large. So she builds it up through the seven synonymous term, showing first at the point of mind, that mind as mind is just stating that God, good, is mind. It's the only mind that the evil is not a mind. Evil is not mind. But evil has not a Christ. Once she has stated that in various ways, you can go to spirit and say, now, if I know that God, good, is the only mind, then we can say that therefore there is only one mind and not many minds. So you come to spirit, where she says that we should not believe in an other power, therefore in an other Christ named evil, that there is only that one mind and not minds many. You see the tone of spirit. Spirit is always that which says, I'm the only, I'm not many. Spirit is that which does away with duality and plurality. Then she goes further to soul and begins to show that God good from the point of view of soul, and says, God, the mind of man never sins. Now, never sins is the aspect of good from the point of view of soul, because soul never sins. Therefore, man has never fallen. Soul is the balance of soul. It doesn't come nor go. Therefore, it cannot lose its identity. Therefore, man has never lost its true standard, has never fallen away from deity. So she says here that God, the mind of man, never sins, that the standard of perfection was originally God and man, that God can never lapse into evil. Can you see the counterfeit of soul, of the identity of soul, the unchangeability of soul, the balance of soul, that God never lapses into its opposite? God cannot take down his standard, see? That man is not fallen. Then we come to principle, where we saw that mind, being man's perfect principle, that the principle of man's thinking, so to say, is mind, no more good human beliefs, and so God is the mind of man, so that man has no other mind but that mind which is God. And you can see again, that's the standpoint from which we should look out into our lives, not to say what we from a human standpoint should demonstrate and should work out, but that we take that much higher standpoint, much more powerful standpoint, the standpoint of the Christ idea, the conception of mind. You see, the Christ idea is the primeval conception that mind has, and only mind knows what it has to work out. So we let that mind work within us as a divine principle, and let that work out what it wants to work out. And if we do that, then we can see that perfect principle will work out within us, what? The perfect idea. So it is the Christ again that expresses itself from the perfect principle in the form of perfect man and perfect idea. This relationship of principle and idea, meaning that the principle of man's mind, of man's thinking, must be the divine mind, that is now then exemplified or elaborated through the subtones of life, truth, and love. But I want to make here a quick remark, which is rather interesting in regard to text interpretation and to what is said here. Again, what was the question? What is mind? Well, if a question is what is mind, we usually would accept that now, all through those two pages, Mrs. Eddy would explain always what mind is and does, no matter in which respect, that she would in every paragraph fall back to mind and say mind does this and mind has that and in mind it is so and so and so. But the fact is that if you read those passages, that only up to the subtone of principle does she use the term mind at all. In the subtone of life, truth, and love, she not even mentions anymore the synonymous term mind. What do I want to say with that? I want to say that Mrs. Eddy had a quite a different concept of mind than just writing about the term mind. That apparently she had a tonality of that mind, a tonality of that relationship of the one mind conceiving of its idea as perfect man, and therefore does not even need to use that synonymous term mind as a term, but just goes on depicting the tonality, the subject, the theme of that big tone, that mind is good. Well, all these things are here to be taken into consideration. One should read the text critically and say, well, what does she say? Well, if she talks about mind, why doesn't she talk anymore about mind? Why doesn't she use the term mind anymore? And doing that, one always finds that if one comes to some kind of a exception, anomaly, you see, that may help us very much suddenly to see something bigger. Here we can see that she begins to broaden out the relationship that exists between principle and idea as that Christ idea. You see, the Christ is the relationship between Word and Christianity. See, it is that which leads the Word to the Christ, to relationship, to Christianity, and therefore is also what Mrs. Eddy says, the Christ is the spiritual agreement, the agreement between God and man. It's a spiritual coincidence between God and man. So the Christ is always that which is the mediator between God and man. And if we catch that tone, I think we will be able to read these passages much better. So, under life, she says that, though not she says, that's my epitome, as the harmonious relationship of principle and idea is indestructible. Can you see indestructible? That's the tone of life. Cannot be destroyed. All remains eternally unchangeable. Can you hear the tone of life again? Remains eternally unchangeable. Gives the sense of the eternal unchangeability, the eternal indestructibility. showing therefore what? That starting out from principle, giving a sense that principle, the perfect principle, brings in its relation to man forth a perfect man. Now, what is that relationship at the point of life? She says, and that remains unchangeable for eternity. The relationship of God and man, divine principle and idea, are indestructible in science. God and all that he creates are perfect, that would be principle, and eternal life, and have remained unchanged in its eternal history. Wow! Can you see the eternal history? We don't think about eternal history looking back to the Egyptians and to the Assyrians and to the Greek and to the Romans and so on. We like to have an eternal history. We like to have an eternal history. We are here not for a few days and few years, and then the whole show is over, but it is that we have an eternal life. Therefore, in our present moment and day, we should see that we are just at a point in an eternal history. Who is going to show us what that eternal history is? Who has a mind that is big enough to know what is happening with us in 100 years, in 200 years, in 1,000 years? What human mind is so clever to know what we have to demonstrate in our life? I wonder which human mind knows that. Just demonstrating little, tiny, little things which don't matter in the history of eternality. No. That's not science. Huh? That's fooling around with ordinary metaphysics, with primitive metaphysics, that's all. And all the metaphysical school do that. They fool around with that. How to demonstrate a new car and how to demonstrate to get that nice bag that they have shown in the window and so on. You just read all those books, you see, on metaphysics. That's fooling around with gnats and swallowing them and leaving the camels free. But we should really go to the camels, those big categories, those big problems, and say, golly, if life is eternal, and we have seen life is eternal, that what we have seen in the Christ, you see, what is life in the Christ? And I've seen the answer was always eternal, 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 not temporal. Eternal, eternal, eternal. So humanly, here in the Christ on the level of Christian Science, we have an eternal history. What is going to demonstrate that eternal history? By the Antichrist, which means the Antichrist is when I, from my own human mind, determine what should be my life. That's the Antichrist. The Christ itself is to go out from that divine mind that is good and at the point of life has an eternal history, meaning that that mind conceives of an idea, of an idea, of a plan. That idea is a terrific plan, an eternal plan, and that idea is leading us within that eternal plan. We only have to let it happen with us instead of interfering with God's plan. Do you feel what Mrs. Eddy wants to bring up here as a subject? That Christ idea, not our human conception of good. That's just not good enough. So in life we see that if we let, you see, the divine mind define and determine what the divine mind wants to use, how it wants to use us, and for what purpose it wants to use us, then we can be quite sure that this is starting the eternal history of our true self. Therefore, things will happen in our life that are in line with that divine plan. at the point of truth, she shows that the facts of truth can only be made evident on the ground of scientific truth. She gives here the symbolism by saying that the five corporeal senses, that they can never perceive the plane, that they can never perceive really the truth. Just as the human mind never can really perceive the truth. Just as the human mind cannot line out what our life should be, how it should unfold, how it will be used by God. We cannot line it out. There is only science that can do it. And so she says, you see, it's the same thing as with corporeal senses. They never can really tell us the truth about the stellar universe, about the sun rising and going down in the west. Only science can take that testimony and say, this is a wrong testimony, you see it that way, but I can correct it by scientific reasoning. So she said, let scientific reason, let the truth determine your view, and not just corporeal sense and the testimony of the material senses. And then in love, the last tone of it, which says, therefore the coexistence of God and man should be admitted as factual in spite of the evidence of the material senses. Here you have the closest relationship between God and man. We said the Christ is always that relationship between God and the idea, between principle and idea. And so at the point of love, we come to the point where we see that that relationship is a coexistence of God and man, and that we should, and that's love, to admit it to ourselves. Isn't that terrific? To admit to ourselves that right now I can never get away and get out of the Christ idea's plan of my salvation. Never. Never. It's already here and now. And therefore it gives one that present consciousness which says, right now, the Word of God as a Christ, and that Christ is right now working as a Christ idea for an eternal history. I only have to accept it. Instead of what we do, we try to call down the Christ and say, here I have my problems, here I have my difficulties, come along Christ, help me. Well, it doesn't come. It just doesn't come. We should admit that is here, that man is coexisting with God and is right now working out the maximum of good. Then we would have touched the Christ idea.